welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for 1 hour. Our good movie this week is The Hidden Fortress, directed by the great Akira Kurosawa. And our bad movie is 2010, the kind of forgotten sequel to 2001. And this one wasn't directed by Stanley Kubrick, but we're gonna be talking about it because it's gonna be 2010 real soon. We just wanted to, you know, start preparing for the future. But we're gonna talk about Hidden Fortress first. So I'd never seen this one, and I'd always heard it mentioned as an inspiration, a heavy inspiration for Star Wars. And Lucas does talk about it on the Criterion DVD. I haven't watched that feature yet, but it bears fairly little resemblance to Star Wars. That's not really a fair comparison. It's really kind of its own adventurous thing. It takes place in feudal Japan, and you know, like many Kurosawa films, and it's got this strange structure where it starts out with these two bumbling peasants who are not likable. It seems like they're going to start being likable any minute because they're so bumbling and goofy, but there's something about them. They're not even that funny, but they're really kind of believably mangy and stuff. And I think Kurosawa really likes these kind of characters. There's always some really, like, mangy, you know, desperate peasants out for whatever they can get in the hard times of feudal Japan. And these are two characters in that kind of mold of his, and they're, you know, well, the movie opens with them, and they just kind of get the movie to the point where it can really begin, which is we find out gradually with them that even though this territory was conquered in a war between feuding lords' houses, which they unsuccessfully tried to profiteer off of. Once they arrived there, the battle was over, and they were mistaken for the enemy, and they were forced to bury the dead. Ha ha. They end up finding some gold hidden in sticks in a ravine, and turns out that this gold is the treasure of the family that was conquered. And as they're, you know, as they've got gold rush fever, suddenly they spot Toshiro Mifune of many other Kurosawa movies, and he's following him, and they're like, oh, we better not let on to this guy. And as it turns out, he was the general of the defeated clan's army. And he's looking out for the princess of the fiefdom, I guess it would be, who's living in exile in the titular hidden fortress. And the movie doesn't spend that long there, because in a nutshell, the general has to get the princess out of there, and to do that, he uses these two bumbling idiots by exploiting their greed, saying, you know, help us carry our gold, and we'll reward you, obviously. But they don't know that the princess is the princess, because Mifune's cover for the princess is to say that she's mute, so that she won't be detected when he's trying to smuggle her through the enemy kingdom. And the other reason he takes along these two idiot peasants is that they actually came up with a good plan to sneak through the enemy territory where they would be least suspected and sneak into a friendly kingdom, which it's presumed the defeated clan has an arrangement with, that they can go into exile there and start rebuilding the family. Anyways, but I was so surprised that these two bumbling characters. I think I've heard people compare them to C-3PO and R2, but that's probably just because one is tall and one is short.
Yeah, I mean,
they're
really the problem.
They're nothing at all like those characters, and the princess is nothing at all like Well, she's maybe a little bit like Princess Leia, but she's stronger than Princess Leia. She's way more of a tough chick.
And Star Wars never has the sort of political implications of she's the caring ruler versus the uncaring ones everybody else has, which sort of plays into it a little.
Yeah, George Lucas thinks that queens are elected, as evidenced by the prequels.
And also, yeah, when I was watching it this time, because the last time I saw it, I think I was like 14, and I had just heard of it as the Star Wars, whatever, the remake. Star Wars is a remake of it. And so I can't decide if they're, because they really don't fit. It is just the two guys. But also, Han Solo and Chewbacca are actually the war profiteers in Star Wars.
It's true.
So I guess it's not really a... It's very loose.
Yeah,
that this is a.
Yeah, people must just get mistaken by the fact that there's horizontal wipes to transition between scenes. They see that in the first few minutes, and they're like, "Oh, Star Wars! This is like the original Star Wars."
Yeah, and there is. I mean, there's the princess thing, and I mean, I guess you could say, whatever. But Mufone's nearest comparison would be to. What, Obi-Wan Kenobi?
Yeah, he's not... I mean, I think it's a fool's errand to try to figure out the Star Wars analogy for him.
But all I could think of was that, you know, Lucas should have... he should have actually turned this into Episode 1. Just done a straight remake of it, because What's-His-Face would have been great. Ewan McGregor or something like that. Or they could do another one that was actually good. Make up for the last three.
I think they should do that. Anyways.
Because as the movie progresses, it gets bigger and bigger in some ways. Like, in terms of how many sort of... The action scenes. The beginning isn't a lot of action scenes. I mean, there are a lot of extras in at the prison break at the beginning.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole thing definitely has an epic feel, like, all the way through. Because... Well, I mean, Kurosawa being the great director that he is, he knows how to take the frame and make you feel like you're in feudal Japan.
And this one is actually his first Toho scope, which is the equivalent of Panavision.
Yeah.
So when you're seeing him frame stuff, it's really kind of interesting because he's learning in some ways, you can feel. And I noticed a couple times when it seemed like the actors weren't quite sure where the camera was going to be. Just a couple times. And it was just,
There's some amazingly framed shots that are static where, like, the environment around them is, like, when the two thieves or two peasants... find the water reservoir in the Hidden Fortress. By the way, Hidden Fortress makes it sound bigger than it is. It's like a hidden shack with a neat secret passageway through the mountain. But when they find this water reservoir, it's like the shot where they're you know, lapping it up. Like, just the way the growth around them frames them, but it looks completely natural. Even though it must have taken a really long time to set up, it's it's great. Kurosawa was obviously a natural with his widescreen photography. You need to be able to direct horses well to get that period feel in widescreen, and he had somebody directing the horses really well.
Yeah, especially at the end. Which, I mean, the other thing is that this is mostly a comedy, and so. I think, you know, trying to describe it is difficult because, yeah, it's set in feudal Japan, but... And it's Kurosawa who really doesn't do a lot of comedies.
I would say it's mostly comedy during that first... maybe it's the first third, but maybe it's either the first third or the first quarter of the movie is really just the two peasants, and that's the comedy-heavy part of it. It's kind of a way of easing you into a more dramatic story because... as the peasants discover Mifune and the princess, they kind of, even though we're even though we've spent more time with the peasants, the, you know, Mifune just, you know, being the incredible presence that he has, and also the actress, let's see if I can pronounce this, Misa Uehara, who plays the princess, she's also really striking, and they kind of become the characters that you care the most about, even though you don't, you meet the princess even later than, not that much later, but a little later than Mifune. And when Mifune shows up, it seems like, you know, he's going to be the bad guy. But then he just steals the show, obviously.
I think when he shows up, we haven't established yet that the two peasants are going to be bad yet. Like that, because they're constantly trying to sell out the princess. So
yeah,
they're not like good guys. It's really kind of funny.
That's what I mean by you keep waiting for them to be likable. Right from the start, they're fighting amongst themselves. You know, like they double cross each other in a second, and then I guess the first time you know that they're really not honorable is when they're ready to when they're alone with the princess and Mifune is gone to scout something, and they're like, let's just run off with the gold now, and they do, and because they think that the princess is mute, but. Just a mute girl, but
Next time you think they're really sleazy when they're alone with the princess again and she's asleep and they're drawing lots to see who gets to put the moves on her.
Yeah,
I mean
that's closer to the end of the movie, but I think by then you've accepted how sleazy they are.
Yeah, I mean in that one, it's kind of, I think the last one that I just mentioned, they put that in there just for a little bit of comic relief. Because that's kind of the kind of comic relief they become, is you're just, it's incredulous what little turds they are. Not just to the main characters, but to each other, too, all the time. Bickering little turds. And I can't believe they didn't spin these guys off into their own film series.
Well,
I really can't.
Yeah, I was thinking that, too. I was thinking... they could sort of be incorporated into any adventure story. You just have them show up at the beginning, discover the main characters as strangers, and let the audience be introduced to the main characters that way, the real main characters. Then have the main characters go on an adventure where the peasants are trying to take advantage of them, but they're too ineffectual to ever seriously, well, actually to ever hamper their quest at all. And then at the end they're off to somewhere else. This is one of those movies where it's kind of like Korean movie we watched on our show about the guy who falls in love online with a girl who travels from Japan to meet him. Because that movie had like five endings at the end. And the first one would leave you feeling satisfied enough, but then each one is like progressively more satisfying because everybody gets a satisfying conclusion, and there's way more characters in this than in that movie, but everybody does get even the two thieves, and they don't you know, it's not a W.C. Fields ending, but they do, you know, they get what they deserve, which is not much, but they're happy. And maybe they've even learned a little generosity towards each other.
And because the movie sort of becomes episodic in some ways, because it's a traveling movie, but it's a traveling movie that has that sort of comedy heavy front end, or not, but front piece with the two bumbling peasants. And so then it, you know, there are a lot of fade outs. Where, you know, an episode ends.
Yeah.
And then there's this really cool part where they're explaining at the beginning, where they're explaining to Mifune their great plan, which is probably they came up with on the spot because they're not very bright guys, but they can talk. Where they draw the map in the sand of where these three, I don't know, are they provinces or whatever? They're not really provinces, whatever they are.
Territories controlled by feudal families.
Right. So they draw the map, and so you can visualize how this is going to play out. And even though they don't make a big deal out of the journey, you still got that at the beginning, so you know kind of what they're doing as the story progresses. My one problem with the sort of logic in the movie is it's never clear to me how they found out about the gold being in the sticks, how the bad guys found out about the gold being in the sticks, and that becomes a plot point when they're hunting down the fugitives.
Well, isn't it because like they're entering an enemy village and Mifune has to act like he found one of those? Oh no, he just shows them the gold bar, doesn't he? It's not hidden in a stick.
Yeah. Wait, or is? I don't. Yeah.
No, I don't think it was. So yeah, they kind of overlooked that.
But that's a very minor quibble. And so as it. It introduces other characters, and it's really kind of deceptive because the way it opens, it's not a heavy Kurosawa movie. It's kind of like a really incredibly well-made light Kurosawa, and he only, you know, I think this is the only thing I've seen of his that I call a comedy. 'Cause Yojimbo's got some funny parts in it, but it's not a comedy at all.
Yeah, and Seven Samurai has funny parts, but I mean, Toshirô Mifune is hilarious in that movie, but yeah, not a comedy.
And this one, it's so amazing that you get to the end and then people are making fun of Mifune, which I love in the last scene, which kind of feels a little bit like the last scene in Star Wars, but a little. I mean, we're stretching
at this
point.
I felt that too.
We're stretching at this
point.
Well,
we brought it up. We might as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when the peasants get their reward from the princess, who's now safely back, or safely, you know, safe in a kingdom, it's a bit like the ceremonial thing at the end of Star Wars.
And, okay, so in that scene, Mifune's all in his huge warrior garb, and the princess is talking about how handsome he is and stuff like that, and his buddy, who would be the equivalent in Star Wars of Darth Vader. I mean, that's why this is so absurd. It's Darth Vader at the end of Star Wars goes off with the rebels and hangs out with them. They're laughing at Mifune. It's just this great little thing, because we just spent the last 5 or 6 minutes with the peasants on their misadventures, and now we're back sort of in the primary likable characters. But, I mean, the Star Wars comparisons are so slight that, remember the scene where they're camped out listening to at the beginning when they just meet Mifune, they're camped out, and they're kind of looking around at all the sounds in the night?
Mm-hmm.
That's like that scene in Three Amigos. That's, you know, yet 5 more scenes that Three Amigos does. Three Amigos is a remake of Hidden Fortress 2. I mean,
yeah.
That's how. But what's strange about the Star Wars thing is apparently at one point they were going to actually buy the rights to Hidden Fortress and remake it straight. Early on in the Star Wars thing, before I guess they figured out to set it in space.
So I guess this was before it was going to be a Buck Rogers movie.
Well, it's the Gary Kurtz, the producer of Star Wars Empire, and I don't think he produced Jedi, but he produced American Graffiti. He, you know, at some convention just before the prequel trilogies came out, talked about all the stuff they planned on doing before Lucas kind of went nuts with whatever Lucas went nuts with around Jedi. And so one of the things he mentioned was that Hidden Fortress, it was going to be a lot more literal of a remake, and they're going to do that. And some of it, I mean, you can see, Kurosawa makes Japan look like it looks like he shoots it like people shoot Alien Planet Vistas now. I mean, just at the ending.
How they shoot deserts when they want it to look like another planet.
Well, and at the ending when they're looking out at the other they're looking out at the place where they're meaning to get.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what it's called. But the last sort of territory where they're going to be safe. Where do you ever see that in any other kind of film anymore, except for sci-fi movies, really?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, yeah, so I'm
yeah,
rambling.
Well, it's I mean, they could, you could set the story in space, but it's all on foot. I mean, it would be like Star Wars set entirely on Tatooine.
That's what I thought. Maybe at the point where they didn't think they could get any money, they were going to do a direct remake of it, which would have been interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, yeah, like we said, yeah.
The story is so mythic and archetypal and everything that yeah, it could set it in space for sure. It could be aliens, just as long as you have, you know, kingdoms and princes and princesses in space.
Uh-oh, no, it's Krull. That's what it is. It's Krull, man. Have you ever tried watching Krull? It's Krull. Anyway, moving on.
No.
Look up Krull, but yeah, what we just described is Krull. That was a terrible idea. I'm sorry.
Well, but, about the juggling of characters, you know, there's the literal title is The Three Villains of the Hidden Fortress. And now, do you think that's supposed to refer to the two peasants in Mifune, or I guess it must, because, you know, who else would be a trio? There isn't another trio of people from the Hidden Fortress. Well, there isn't another trio until the end of the movie where Mifune's old buddy shows up and eventually comes to his side. So I guess, yeah, the three villains, that would be the two peasants and Mifune, even if Mifune is not really a villain. And calling the two bumbling peasants a, you know, villain is a stretch, but that's probably a language thing.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, that maybe using the word villain... Yeah.
Using the word villain to mean just a, you know, a jerk.
Yeah, because, like, you know, I didn't really remember it when it started, and the new translation has the three villains of the Hidden Fortress.
Oh, here's a couple of other English titles that were used. Three bad men in a hidden fortress, and three rascals in the hidden fortress.
Three rascals seems to work a little bit better, but only a little, because Mufone really isn't much of a rascal. Oh yeah, I wanted to talk about the big long spear fight.
Yeah,
I mean, that is this ornate sort of battle fight scene.
Yeah, that's a real love of feudal Japan in a Japanese movie, because the movie just stops dead in its tracks to have a spear duel between Mifune and his former friend in real time.
And I can't. I wish I timed it, but I imagine it's got to be 5 to 7 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just... because they're spears, too. So you're seeing the physical... You know, they're very physical weapons.
They can't get fancy with it, like swords.
I don't know. Mifune swings that thing around a couple times. I'm like, they must have had him working out for this.
Well, I don't mean, like, the fight choreography isn't good. I just mean that it's harder to make spears look cinematically exciting than... swords, which are flashy and sharp on both edges.
Well, especially since, how many shots did Kurosawa use on that whole scene? Because the camera follows the guys around, because they move through.
Most of it is wide shots, so that you can see the reactions of all the army surrounding who have stepped back to watch the duel.
And that's kind of in this segment, you know, since the film is sort of in segments.
One of the later segments.
Where Mifune sort of becomes, really, I think maybe for the first time, the principal. Because he's always around the other times, but he rarely gets to, I mean, it starts with him chasing down the bad guys
It almost goes from the peasants being the main characters to the princess being the main character to finally Mifune.
Because the princess is funny, is one of the things.
Yeah, she's so serious. She takes herself so seriously, but that's just funny sometimes.
Yeah, so... And then you have this long fight scene, and then it just stops. I think it might even end on a fade-out.
Right, because he doesn't kill his old friend. He breaks his spear, and the guy just says, "Well, I'm defeated. You may go." And... Mifune, you know, being an honorable samurai doesn't kill him. And you probably think that's the last you're going to see of that guy, because it's not, he's introduced in that scene. Like, he and Mifune recognize each other, and it's like, oh yeah, you know, we used to know each other, and now you work for the opposing army, and we're going to have a duel now. And then when he shows up at the end, he steps out of shadows after Mifune and the princess and their other companion, who I guess we'll get to, have been captured towards the end of the movie, where it seems like all is lost. This defeated character steps out of the shadows with a bad scar on his face, like Darth Vader, and says, you know what, when he's standing in the shadows, I mean, there's something about the clothes he's wearing almost makes him look like he's an unmasked Darth Vader with, you know, heavy shoulder pads and headgear around his neck. But yeah, he comes out, and he was scarred by his lord because he lost the fight. And this scene is one of the five endings, by the way. It's like the second or third one, where the movie could have ended there and it would have been sad, but it would have been perfect because of the dialogue. And like, yeah, then spoiler alert, he saves them all in the end. He's the biggest hero, and because this is a crowd pleaser, he doesn't even have to sacrifice his life. He actually gets to go off with him.
Yeah, and then he shows up at the ending for a little bit of comic relief. And that scene where he's reintroduced is also, I guess, one of the in terms of the torpid Japanese feudal monarchy structure, royalty structure. I mean, you've got Mifune apologizing to the princess for getting her killed, essentially getting her caught and killed. And It's never really said that maybe he shouldn't have relied so much on those two idiot peasants, but that's the subtext. And then all of a sudden she goes, well, no, I had a great time. Yeah, and it's just, and it becomes that, you know, royalty getting to live among the people,
yeah,
and not being treated with, sort of, you know,
yeah,
on a pillow. And then she sings this song, you know, and the really cool part about it is because of the way Kurosawa doesn't really fix on any characters except the peasants throughout, when she says she had a great time at the fire dance festival, it's hilarious because, you know,
yeah, and it's funny. And actually, if you look in the earlier in a fire dance sequence where she learns the song that she sings, you do see her smiling.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's just this really nice sort of,
it would have been a great, it would have been a great sad ending if it ended right there, but then they give us a great happy ending.
Yeah. And then they give us another happy ending.
And then half of one, with the peasants. So, yeah, there's this other companion that's in this traveling band who's, you know, and this is where you have to say it's not that much of a comedy, because they commit to the, you know, how barbaric things could be in feudal Japan. This peasant girl who, I don't believe, well, she has only a few lines, but what happens is they, when they're hiding out amongst, amongst the peasants of the territory whose lord won the war, one of the peasants has a former resident of their kingdom, which they've now lost, and she's a slave, and she's a slave who refuses to put out too. So her owner wants to sell her because he can't use her as a prostitute. So that's really ugly, and the princess, being the good person that she is, insists to Mifune that they buy her, and then it turns out to be fortuitous for them, because then when soldiers are looking for a certain number of people, they're a different number of people, and they've also lost their horses. But anyway, this girl, who is only credited as farmer's daughter bought from slave trader in the credits on IMDb, she just silently expresses her gratitude to her princess by trying to, at one point she's wounded. Towards the end of the movie, when things are getting really dangerous for them, she gets wounded and she says, "No, leave me," but they take her, and then she tries one more time when they're captured and Mifune is talking to his old friend. She says, "I'm the princess, take me," and, you know, but it's too late for that. They're not going to buy it. Things work out for her too, of course. I mean, she gets to escape with them as well, although she's not at that ending ceremony scene.
No, she doesn't make that scene.
But her standout scene, though, is when you mentioned before the peasants are thinking about molesting the princess in the middle of the night. She stands by the princess's guard all night with a big rock held over her head.
And, of course, there's the wonderful comedic moment where she has to lift the rock, and it's not easy for her to lift it. And she finally gets it up, and she is terrifying the two peasants.
who are so cowardly that even though they're two men, they're not going to try to take this, you know, farmer's daughter with a rock.
Who, let's not forget, opened the movie by going off to war. I mean, what did they expect to find had there actually been a war for them to go to at the beginning? And that's the other thing, is that the Darth Vader guy with the scar on his face, he goes off with them. He frees them. One of the reasons he frees them is because she's such a caring ruler and he doesn't have that. And once the farmer's daughter finds out that it's her princess and that she's saving her, it's...
That's right, that's because she doesn't know that either.
Right, and then she becomes dedicated to her. Yeah. And the way she never tells her that she knows until
she says that she's the princess trying.
Right.
To,
yeah.
Trying
I mean, that's, take, yeah. And that's the very end. So but you get to see her like protecting her, not in the big rock wielding ways, but also just occasionally she'll, you know, shield the princess in battle scenes and that sort of thing.
The battle scenes at the end are interesting. I mean, they're not really battle scenes, but they're these pretty intense scenes where the enemy army is, you know, drawing closer and closer to the group. And there's that interesting scene where they're, you know, they have to dodge bullets, and it's done in this, you know, the simplest way possible, which is just have your actors run behind the hill, stop the camera, fire some rounds at the hill.
Yeah.
Start the camera again. It looks totally fake, but, it's perfectly forgivable.
And I thought that was really interesting, because you don't really...
You don't expect guns in feudal movies. Also, that's kind of uncommon, because it kind of takes away from the fun of feudalism. But it's used effectively. And I kind of like when the peasants have that the cowardly peasants have that moment near the beginning where they're like, you know, yeah, but they've got guns, you know, bang and you're dead. Simple as that. It's like they're, you know, it's like guns are a new thing to them. They're like, oh, you know.
And there is that scene at the beginning the beginning is kind of, I guess, when you'd say they're like R2 and C-3PO, because they split up and they both have their separate adventures when they're trying to do whatever. And they're running down the hill but they only hook up with idiots too, which is really funny. So one of the guys, the taller one, he gets into a band of three other guys who bumble around, and then the fog clears and they're right there and they're getting shot down. And the gun Yojimbo deals with the gun totally differently. The gun in Yojimbo is this huge deal. The guy's got the gun. He can, you know.
Yeah, he's the only guy in town with a gun.
And, you know, that just, it's a game changer. In this, it's sort of this understated it's still a game changer, but they never reflect on that. Mm-hmm. Instead, it just every once in a while you hear hear a gunshot and drop.
Right, because most soldiers at this point do not have their own rifles. That's still way too expensive for feudal armies.
Yeah.
Most guys are swords and horses and maybe a spear, and that does just fine.
And I don't think we ever actually see any of that. It's kind of got battle scenes without any battle going on in some ways.
Yeah, no, it's true. And even the you could probably even nitpick and say that when Mifune cuts down guys off their horses with his sword, it's stagey. Although the beginning of the scene, or rather the prelude to the big stop everything for this spear duel scene, is Mifune riding on horseback fast as he can after some enemy army soldiers who have identified them and are trying to ride off. He kills one of them, but then there's two of them riding off, two or three, to warn the others, and he has to catch up with them and kill them. And there's a couple of amazing, tracking shots of Mifune on that horse where it almost looks like he's on wires or something. Like, they put him on wires. They hoisted him on wires on top of the horse so that he's sitting on the horse with his blade drawn, and he's, perfectly still, even though the horse is galloping, and the camera is, gliding along with him, and he seems otherworldly. He really... It's one of those moments of Kurosawa directing Mifune where you have no doubt in your mind that he's a real samurai.
Yeah. And in some ways, I think... Well, no, he hadn't done Yojimbo yet, had he?
Let me see. That was in the... Oh, wait, no, he hadn't. No. That was Which like is kind that of was fun. Like 63.
Yeah, because he is so iconic in this. Mifune is completely iconic in this as sort of, it's the equivalent of two bumbling idiots run into Clint Eastwood,
right.
Not Clint Eastwood from Gunsmoke, Clint Eastwood after, the spaghetti westerns. And it, even if Mifune wasn't iconic at that point, it sort of plays into it. Just his way of handling
it. I don't think he was. I'm looking at his resume and I don't see, any Kurosawa or Oh, wait a second. Oh, he did Throne of Blood before this. Oh, that's interesting.
Okay.
Although that's Macbeth in feudal Japan, so the samurai thing isn't really the centerpiece of it. But no, I think it looks like Throne of Blood was his only other Kurosawa movie before this.
Wasn't he in Scandal?
I never seen that one.
That one's really good. That was on my list of things we might watch if we ever needed good movies. I think he is. Or not.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, he is. Okay. He had done
pre-Seven Samurai as well, so pre-iconic.
But, maybe not, because he had done, I'm looking at his filmography here with translations, and he had done other things. Vendetta for a Samurai, not directed by Kurosawa, directed by somebody else. So maybe...
Freaking Rashomon.
And Seven Samurai is actually 54. And then he did the Samurai Trilogy, which I know is out from Criterion, or at least it was. And it's a trilogy of...
So never mind everything I just said.
Yeah, we don't know what we're talking about. But apparently he would have been iconic showing up.
Uh-huh.
It would have been.
And it's funny when he shows up in the movie, because we see him as the peasants see him, which is like this... figure far off in a distance, but obviously very, very threatening, very imposing.
Yeah, they're so worried about him, and he's way far away. And the reason that they have to fear him is because it is Toshiro Mifune. Yeah. So I think we've run out of things we actually know to talk about at this point for mid-century Japanese cinema.
Yeah, just because we like stuff doesn't mean we know.
We don't know anything about it, sorry.
Yeah, we're discovering along with you, folks.
So
what else is great about this movie? Let's see. Or what else did George Lucas steal?
The composition. Come on. I mean, the Panavision composition that Kurosawa is doing here is just, it's just fantastic, because it's not like the, I think we mentioned this when we watched Yojimbo, that he doesn't really do it in the U.S. way at this point, where it was to combat television by putting more on the screen, but he still does that because it's still his first Panavision movie, and so he does have the scene where you have the two guys framed on either end of the scene that would make it impossible to watch Pan and Scan.
And also he uses the fact that this story has a shifting cast of main characters, or rather the role of the main character is shared throughout the movie, like the two bumbling peasants kind of share it together, but Mifune and the princess get their turns with it. They're a group, and they're on this quest essentially to escape. And he comes up with all these great ways to frame them together, whether it's three of them or four of them or five of them when they've got the farmer's daughter with them. You know, frame them in ways that shows their relationship and shows how things are going. Like, because, you know, when he's, or even just, you know, or even just a shot, a big shot of one person to make a big impact, like when we see the sleeping princess from the peasant's point of view, she's very alluring.
And that actually,
like, looks like a glamour shot of her sleeping.
Her pose kind of reminded me of Princess Leia when Luke goes in on her before
That's
he knows
right.
he's her sister. You know, there's little stuff. But the thing is, yeah, I'm sure Lucas aped a bunch from other Kurosawa movies. And John Ford, he aped a bunch from The Searchers. Nobody ever mentions that. But anyway. Okay.
Yeah, that's the Princess Leia pose.
Yeah, except Princess Leia wasn't wearing short shorts for the entire movie.
I don't know. You're seeing some leg with the... Because, like, what, that white dress is, like, slipped up the side, isn't it?
Oh, is it? I can't...
It's been a while.
It's been a while, and, you know, come on, man, that's Luke's sister you're talking about here.
Oh, I feel so dirty.
Yeah. Okay. So, Hidden Fortress. Did you watch the DVD, or did you watch the Netflix streaming?
I could have watched the Netflix streaming, but I watched the DVD.
Cool. It's a nice print. I mean, the Netflix streaming is just the DVD, so since apparently Criterion is putting stuff online, you can watch it streaming from their site. I've never really tried to do it, but
yep.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, check it out.
Yeah.
It's not, I gotta admit, it's not my favorite Kurosawa I've seen, but the guy's so good. Everything he does is good.
The last time I saw it when I was like 14, I really didn't care for it that much, and I really think that not thinking about it as a Star Wars whatever source material helps.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But also...
Again, ignore everything we've said, because
yeah,
you're
going
to be disappointed if you go
it's
into
a crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, you really enjoy it by the time you reach the third act, and there's a lot of payoff for the viewer, and that's kind of weird from Kurosawa that he worries so much about that. The guy made High and Low worrying about making you happy. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now we're on to our next movie, which is a little bit early. It's 10 days early, I guess. Or whatever. 5 days early. Six.
Well, we've only got 10 days to do it because something wonderful is going to happen.
We don't actually know when the date of the movie is. I'm pretty sure the date of the movie...
Well, we do, because the guy says, you know... Well, the guy, Roy Scheider, says, you know, we got to find out what happened 9 years ago. So it is 2010.
Oh, no, it's 2010, but I'm sure the date, the actual date, is in the novel. Because the novel was very specific about that.
I was so surprised to find out that the novel was only written a couple of years before the movie was made.
Because
I knew that there were sequels to 2001 that Arthur C. Clarke had written. I just thought he wrote them within a span of a few years, or even 10 years. Not you know, basically to get more movies made.
Yeah, no, it was cha-ching, cha-ching. He needed to make some money. So he wrote 2010. And that's actually a lousy thing to say about it, because I think I still kept my copy of it, and I tossed, like, all of my sci-fi books from high school, and I did keep 2010. And
So it's a good novel, at least?
It's all right, I think. I haven't read it in 15 years. But yeah, no, it's better than the movie. How's that?
I believe it.
When you suggested this, I said it's not that bad. And I still stand by that. It's
yeah, and then
useless.
I was like, and I was like, oh, is it good? And you're like, well, I wouldn't say that.
It's got good special effects.
Let me guess, it's worse than you remember.
No, because I actually saw it about 6 years ago.
Oh.
It's because the DVD came out, and it was like $4 someplace. I'm like, oh, I haven't seen 2010 in a while, so let me see it. And the first time I saw this, I saw it pan and scan, which is completely – it's one of the worst pan and scan movies. In the same way that I guess you could say that Hidden Fortress would be unwatchable. There's the Arthur – C. Clarke cameo in front of the White House.
Right.
He's not there in the pan and scan version.
Yeah.
You have no idea what people are talking about when they say that he's cameos in it. And the other thing about Hames's composition in this, I mean, I actually like Hames from this period until about 89. I like Peter Hames generally. I mean, he doesn't make great movies, but he's fine. And this, what I found so funny was, is he actually needed to shoot 4:1. I bet if he'd shot this movie 4:1, it'd be just amazing. Because that scene at the beginning when Dana Eclair, who's famous from what? The guy who does the bad Russian accent at the beginning.
It's
MacGyver. The MacGyver guy. Okay, okay. Wow.
It's also Elker, not Eclair.
Oh.
Chocolate Eclair.
Yeah, sorry. Elker. So there's like this scene at the beginning when he and Roy Scheider are talking, and one of them is it's actually like they split it. It's like they had to cut it in half, and you can tell that Hames would have liked to have been able to shoot, what would it be, 4:6:5:1, so they both could be on opposite ends of this huge thing. And I mean, that's kind of interesting. And the way they don't really glamorize space is interesting.
Well, the handling of space is one of my biggest problems with it.
Well, I didn't say it was good. I said it was interesting.
Well, it's interesting because Richard Edlund did the effects, and he did Ghostbusters. He was very good, even in 84, at kind of matching foreground and background stuff and composing a frame where everything is done practically, but it feels three-dimensional. And even in front of like even in front of matte paintings and stuff, or blue screens or whatever they used. In fact, the fact I can't tell what they used speaks very highly of it. Yeah, space does look great in this. It just feels completely different as a movie in space from the original.
Yeah, and I think that what are the two like key things I said about this? One is that it feels like Terminator 4. Being a sequel to Terminator or Terminator 2. It's about that. It's like this revisionist sort of commercialized sequel by somebody totally unrelated to the first movie. Yeah, but just in terms of...
With obligatory token nods to the original.
Including a cameo. Hello. And like, we got Keira D'Elia back. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, like the entire plot is dependent upon the original, but it adds nothing.
And then the other thing is, it feels like it was supposed to be a mini series, and they cut a bunch out of it. It's like when you hear about those like 7-hour mini series, they cut down to theatrical release running times
because like in the final act, Russia and the United States go to war, and suddenly you've got all these Russian cosmonauts and American astronauts on the same space station, and seems like things are about to get horribly contentious because their two countries are at war, but it's just ignored. it's not really an issue for them.
Well, they have this thing, you know, get everybody off the bridge so I can come over and talk to you. There was that. But yeah, I mean, there's all these, and I don't know if it's...
But during the whole movie, they're teasing World War III. And then it actually breaks out, and... It's not a big deal because, you know, the space baby is about to solve all everybody's problems and end the Cold War.
Let's not forget that the space baby shows up for that one scene where you know, you see it and it's a reference to the first movie, except it's never explained what was up with the space baby being at the, on Earth, at Earth, at the end of the first movie. And as a sequel that sort of explains things left unexplained in the first one, it does a really bad job.
It raises more questions than it answers, and the stuff that it answers was answered already, because, I mean, not many people know this, but Arthur C. Clarke actually wrote the novel and the screenplay in tandem, and the novel was almost like an appendix for the movie. Like, you were supposed to see the movie and not get everything that was going on, but then read the novel and, you know, get some basic stuff. And it's not, you know, yeah, the monoliths are mysterious, but once you get that they're, you know, sent by extra-dimensional beings to further the evolution of human life, then pretty much everything clicks into place. But in 2010, you've got, like, a swirling drain of monoliths on Jupiter that turns into a black hole that turns Jupiter into a sun, and it's like, what? Is that why there are monoliths? Like,
did you like the CG monoliths?
They weren't too bad, because whatever, it's a big black rectangle.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it's... And the, you know, the what, interest...
Yeah. Yes, what's interesting?
Well, no, I mean, the questions that it could have answered that were interesting were, like, what's the deal with Bowman? I mean, none of that's explained. They have all of his costume changes from the last 15 minutes of 2001, but he just sort of switches into that persona.
Well,
I
was astonished that, like, they got the main character. I mean, the actor from 68 in the original, and he still looks really good. He pretty much looks the same. I guess that's why they decided to use him as much as they did, because it's a pretty extended cameo. He kind of dominates, like, the last act of the movie. In fact, like, he almost becomes the main character instead of Roy Scheider, because, like, what does Roy Scheider have to do but, like, get the fuck out of the way from the from the black hole that Jupiter's becoming?
Yeah, Roy Scheider's already sort of fulfilled his thing, and that's kind of what's weird about it, is you got Roy Scheider at this point was still... I was trying to think of how you would describe Roy Scheider. He's not really the thinking man's action hero, but he's kind of... You know, it's Roy Scheider. It's like, you know, one of your friend's dads is Roy Scheider, and yeah, then he goes off and has these adventures. You know, he's the Blue Thunder pilot on the weekends, or not, and then on the weekends, you know, he takes you to the movies with his kid. And so, and also at the beginning, it seems to be how tan can Roy Scheider get, and how look at how fit his stomach was in that sit-up scene.
Yeah.
And I mean, Roy Scheider, not a young guy when he was doing this, and you just can kind of see him going, can we show my stomach? Can everybody
yeah,
see my
little,
stomach?
It's a little awkward. It's not the prettiest torso in the world.
And then you have this is one of the things that instead of concentrating on Bob Balaban's kind of possibly creepy scientist guy, and I think in the book he actually did go nuts trying to save Hal or something.
He's Indian in the book.
Yeah, and he's Bob Balaban in the movie. And did you notice that he works at University of Chicago? Not only do they have the big University of Chicago computer lab thing, he also wears the shirt. But so then, instead of showing what he's doing to get ready, except for the one... Well, we don't see John Lithgow at all on Earth.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that, like, Scheider wakes up out of hypersleep, let's call it, on, you know, with all these cosmonauts, and he's, like, it's not until a little bit later that Balaban and Lithgow come out of hypersleep, and not only is Balaban's, you know, potentially very interesting... Well, he invented Hal. That's interesting enough on its own. And he has, like, a computer girlfriend named Sal that he has at the University of Chicago. And that's a, you know, decent scene, and he's a really wasted character. But Lithgow is introduced for the first time when he comes out of hypersleep, and then his character isn't given anything to do but strike a lame friendship with one of the cosmonauts who apparently he had a bisexual relationship with in the novel. And, you know, I guess bisexuality was really futuristic in 1982.
Wait, where was that? Where are you reading that? I don't remember that. Hold on, I gotta look that up. It's very sad, you know, and then the cosmonaut dies and sort of the, it's all Helen Mirren playing a Russian's fault, basically.
There we go. The film also omits almost all the romantic physical relationships between the astronauts. In the novel, Helen Mirren is married to the navigator. In the novel, Lithgow is bisexual, and he has a relationship with Maxim Brailovsky, called Max in the movie, but breaks it off when he learns that Xenia Marchenko is in love with Max. And I guess she's the girl who kisses Roy Scheider after they survive the rough entry into...
And that was a big deal. I think that's basically what I'm remembering from it, is that 2010 is a... You know, it's like a disaster.
It's so
movie,
it's
novel
such a
thing.
Poseidon adventure movie, yeah.
But it's too short. I mean, it's too short for a number of reasons. One, the characters kind of get dropped off. I mean, at a certain point, it doesn't matter that you didn't
learn any
of the Russian
names. That girl who kisses Roy Scheider, absolutely nothing comes of that.
No.
Even though in the novel, Roy Scheider's wife leaves him because he's spending too long in space, and that would have been the perfect opportunity to have him hook up with the Russian. But,
voicemail letters were stupid, too. When he's like, he's explaining to them what's going on, that's stupid.
Well, here's one of my big, like, it feels like the wrong space problems. When you see shots of the space station and you hear Roy Scheider doing voiceover of the letter that he's written back to his wife, so that the audience knows what's going on, it's like an old fucking Star Trek episode where Shatner's talking about, we're now approaching the mysterious void. I don't know what's going to become of the crew, but all we can do is press onward. We have to know. We have to find out. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that the novel is very meticulous in describing stuff. And so in the movie, they just skip through it. And
does 2010 not have the grandeur of space that Kubrick gave to 2001, but it doesn't even have the grandeur of a Star Trek movie. It has the grandeur of a Star Trek episode with like the budget of a Star Trek movie. But it feels when it's over, I swear to God, it felt like it was a half an hour long.
Yeah,
not because it was fun, but because it was so like half baked.
And I think some of it, some of the lack of space. Well, I mean, Peter Hames is
a lot of space in it, and
there's a lot. No, well, think about what there's a lot of space of. There's a lot of space of them going back and forth between the ships. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a huge thing
between their ship and the ship from 2001 that's been floating around Jupiter.
Which looks really nice still, even though it's now got a little bit of a red tint compared to the Russians' hideous spaceship, because they're Russian. And, you know, the first movie had... it did comment on Soviet-U.S. relations, and it just didn't do it in this lame sort of... I mean, comparing the dialogue from 2001 to the dialogue from 2010, it's just painful.
Even Hal sounds dumber.
I mean, just the way, you know...
Roy Scheider. It's the same voice as Hal. He came back, too.
Yeah, and I love Roy Scheider, but he really did not pick good scripts for his big movies. And that's, you know, kind of what this is.
It's a would-be big movie.
It's a would-be big movie, and I think that... I can't believe that they didn't let... So some of the space stuff has to be that they just didn't get the budget for it, right? There were budgetary limitations.
Well, where are you thinking of? Because they had the budget for the production designer to recreate the sets from 2001, which were apparently destroyed by Kubrick in just such a case that they would try to make a sequel.
Well, they only had to recreate a handful of the sets from 2001. And they didn't recreate the huge... Remember he did that thing where it sort of spun around on a huge...
Yeah, that awesome hamster wheel thing of...
I'm sure they didn't redo that. Even though that one scene where they come into the Discovery and they're walking along the wall, that was cool.
Well, that's like one of the cool... It's like he didn't know what the coolest things about 2000 and Peter Hyams?
Hames, I think.
Peter Hyams. He didn't know what the coolest things were about 2001. He just knew what the most memorable things were, like Hal and a space baby. But, like, yeah, there's only a couple of shots where people are walking on the walls, and that was one of the most, you know, eye-popping things in 2001 just from a special effects standpoint. And with the technology having improved so much, they should have had a lot more of that. You know, because, oh, man, you know what? It's like when people come out of hypersleep, and the reason I'm thinking of it as hypersleep on the Soviet ship is because it feels more like Alien than 2001. And there's two big reasons for that. One is that not only is the ship ugly, but, like, all the astronauts and, you know, even Roy Scheider, despite his pecs or washboard abs, not really, like, they're all kind of schlubby a little bit, whereas in 2001, like, they did the realistic thing of, like, astronauts have to be, you know, young men in the physical peak of their life.
Right. Well...
But in 2010, you got John Lithgow.
He's not an astronaut. Let's not forget.
He's like, I'm not used to this. I'm an engineer. It's like, did anyone tell you that you would be going up to space for this? You know?
Well, and the sort of revisionist stuff that they do to explain the first one where... I'm trying to think... There are all the things... Oh, that line about the White House that Balaban has about how Hal was told to lie by people... Hal's not programmed to lie. Yeah, he wasn't built to lie.
The big revelation for, you know, question nobody was asking, why did Hal, you know, kill the astronauts in 2001... is that he was programmed... According to this movie, he was programmed to... the contradiction isn't that he was programmed to keep the monolith on Jupiter a secret. The contradiction is that Roy Scheider... This comes as a surprise to Roy Scheider, despite the fact that his character shows up in a video at the end of 2001 to tell... the astronaut to do that revelation. So it's like he forgot he recorded that video.
but it's all the White House's fault, and that's very interesting. That
it's just so, you know, Peter Hames can have that great, you know, wanted to put in what he thought was a great line about, you know, well, they lie to everyone else, why shouldn't they lie to us, or something like that. And did you notice Peter Hames' script, man? I don't know. I'm sure the novel's dialogue and stuff was better because, like, did Peter Hames not notice that he repeated the same line twice about "I hope we still have an Earth to go back to," or whatever it was?
I think I was zoning at that point.
Yeah, I mean, he uses the same clever line that he's proud of twice.
Oh, wow. I'm so excited. Peter Hames is, I'm looking up what he's actually written. Peter Hames' son apparently is directing Universal Soldier 3. And Hames is shooting it. And that's the funny thing about... Wait a minute,
there was a Universal Soldier
3. No, the new one. The new one that's coming out in...
So Universal Soldier The Return with Jean-Claude Van Damme wasn't part 3?
No, that was part 2.
Oh, I thought there was a part 2. But anyways,
there were TV movies. But anyway, okay. This is the new one that's going to have Dolph Lundgren and Van Damme in it and whatever. It's shot on video. The trailer's online. It looks so cheap. Anyway, That's what Peter Hames is doing next. But let me look at what he actually wrote before this. He wrote. He did some writing. Did a Don Siegel. He wrote Capricorn One, which was a conspiracy theory thing. He wrote Outland, which has the same narration problems that 2010 has.
That's a space movie.
It's a space movie. It's a High Noon in Space. It's actually pretty cool. It's
also being remade, apparently.
Oh, great.
By Hames himself. But
wow. I think that maybe trying to compress a novel like 2010 into something blockbustery.
Because the first one was like 3 hours, 3.5 hours or something. Actually, no. I always think it's longer than it is, but it's longer than 2010.
It's not the first one.
It's not like the problem Halloween 2 had of trying to fit the same structure into over a few days from the original into a single night in the sequel. This is just like, just compression. Stuff feels like stuff is missing, and also. One of the big, Peter Hames, he's Australian or something, right?
No, he's from Chicago.
Oh, okay. Well, I was wondering if he had a problem with minorities, because not only is Bob Balaban's character supposed to be Indian, but it's not the Russians in the novel. It's the Chinese who they have to work with. Again, according to Wikipedia, the difference is from the novel section. And that's just so that Hames can make this movie about make a anti-Cold War pacifist movie. Like, it's like he wanted to do that more than, you know, be any kind of continuation of the ideas of 20. That's the thing, is that 2001 has these gigantic ideas. And then 2010 just, I don't know, it doesn't, it's like it, it's not interested in the big ideas that the first movie had. It's just it's much more about Cold War politics, which seems so incredibly petty when you're talking about the mysteries of the universe.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing, is that, and Hames, you know, I actually think that 2010's pretty well made. I mean, it's well directed throughout.
Yeah, it is. It's well made.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, I like some of Hames' other stuff a lot. I'm wondering if he really got 2001 as something that was a.
I think he saw 2001 as an adventure movie.
Okay, like as sort of the.
I think he saw it as a Star Trek movie.
Right. Was it? I think Star Trek the Motion Picture has more in the terms of philosophical explorations than 2010 does. I think Star Trek III probably does too, because that's the one where the search for Spock, they got that whole thing going on. Yeah, that's a lot deeper than this in terms of that. So,
well, I guess the similarity to the search for Spock is that the astronaut David's spirit, having been, you know, turned into the space baby, is now kind of he's now just a ghost, basically. He can show up, he can appear as an apparition to Roy Scheider and give him a warning. And he can go back to Earth to visit his old girlfriends and stuff, and it's like, well, why didn't he do that before?
Exactly. The most interesting thing in the movie is where this guy, who kills Max when he decides to go back to Earth, which is interesting.
Which isn't in the book either.
Well, it's to let Lithgow wear that weird beret in mourning, mm-hmm. I think, because he sort of picks up. Is that Max's beret?
I think it was. Yeah.
That they really should have inserted.
They had to give them a resolution between the two characters that didn't end in bed.
Anyway, okay, so he goes back to Earth and he says goodbye to. And the way Earth is handled is really lame.
It's so obviously 1984 and not the future.
There's a reason Kubrick didn't shoot on Earth in 1968.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
this is why.
But then, like it also doesn't work. It doesn't even. It still feels like 1984 when they're in the space station scenes because it's like casual day. It's not the, you know, antiseptic, squeaky clean prefab. You know, like.
I think too much had happened because there's the commercialization of space. There's that whole Pan Am commercial for space.
Uh-huh.
And the joke, of course, being that that's another one of the things that nobody would get because Pan Am's gone and, you know, Soviet Union's gone. So that's why it's dated.
Yeah, this is the most irrelevant sequel you could make in the long term. But anyway.
I
knew the Cold War was going to end, though.
And ruin chances of a sequel.
The whole Cold War thing is so annoying because there's all this terrible bonding dialogue between the Americans and the Russians where they're learn, you know, the Russians can't get the English turns of phrase right. Lithgow has to teach Max how to say piece of cake and not piece of pie. You know, it's like, oh, that's real cute, but you know, what the hell is it doing in, you know, a sequel to this amazingly thought-provoking movie?
Okay, so, yeah, speaking of the whole Russian-American conflict, I'm thinking about The Abyss, how... wasn't there a whole thing going on in The Abyss with warships? Yes?
I think if there was, it wasn't... painful.
Maybe in the special edition? Right, no, I was giving an example of how maybe they should have done something, because when they're talking about what's going on in Honduras, and we're supposed to know what they're talking about, it's kind of like in RoboCop when they talk about the Brazil War, except we're not supposed to know what's going on. That's part of the texture of the film, is those newscasts with all that information that we don't have any context to, but it clues us in.
Yeah.
This whole Honduras thing, we're supposed to care about it and know what's going on, and we can't possibly because it's fictional.
Yeah, and that's why it's so bad when they've built that up through the whole movie, and then there's this really dramatic scene where they're watching they've got a... Scheider's got a video from his... friend, who I guess is the Secretary of State. No, he's not supposed to be the Secretary of State.
No, but he's he's got Scheider's job.
Yeah, but he's saying America and Russia have gone to war, and it's like it's supposed to be this, you know, my God, the shit has really hit the fan now, thing, and it, you know, well, we're gonna have to talk about the ending pretty soon, where aliens end the Cold War. Let's talk about it now.
And now this is, I'm looking at Wikipedia, and I was pretty sure that I remembered this correctly. Hames added some messages.
Yeah, I was just about to mention.
Yeah.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay, to put the ending simply, after Jupiter has collapsed into a black hole and turned into a sun because of the monoliths, there's Earth now has a second sun, and because Earth now has a second sun, there's no need for America and Russia to be at war, because now you can suntan like Roy Scheider whenever you feel like it, and there's no more conflict.
Well, I think that what they were saying was is this would be proof to the average person of alien power or something. I don't know.
Well, okay. Well, the important thing is, Dave, astronaut Dave, has Hal. You know, they're reunited at last. You know, in kind of a ethereal plane. You hear Dave tell Hal to send a message to Earth as this new sun is being created from Jupiter, and the message in the novel is. All these worlds are yours, except Europa. Europa is one of the moons of Jupiter. Attempt no landings there. And this, well, not only does this kind of harken to the day the Earth stood still, where you've got aliens with a message from space, like kind of warning Earth to back off. And that threat doesn't seem to bother anybody, but I mean, you've got aliens threatening you, seriously. And if aliens were saying, don't go to this planet, you would so go to that planet. I mean, screw them. But more importantly, Peter Hames added the lines to that message, use them together, the worlds that are yours, by the way. Use them together. Use them in peace. So he puts his Cold War spin on it. And that turns it into a message to the entire Earth, to just a message to the United States and Russia. You know, this is just one of those Cold War cinema things where it's like, oh yeah, the world was.
It's like Ruskies.
Oh yeah, the world was considered to be divided into the communist half and the capital and the democratic half. That's how the world used to be. Oh yeah.
And now the other problem with that is the whole Europa thing. The handling in the movie sucks. They basically find life on Europa.
Not only early in the movie.
Yeah, and then
basically when they get there, they're like, "Holy shit, there's trees down there," and then they kind of, you know, they don't try to base any conclusions off of that. And even if there were just a few scenes of like the scientists sitting around like hashing this out and having to come to grips with, you know, what the possibility of intelligent life in the universe means, it would have been blatant and it would have been, you know, surtext, not subtext, but the movie really needed that. It needed to be about that and not the Cold War.
So,
And by the way, speaking of Star Trek one more time, wasn't that the plot of Star Trek 2 and 3, that there was a special invention that could create life?
It's the monolith. They made their own monolith. No.
But it was the Genesis something.
It was the Genesis torpedo. Project Genesis. Mm-hmm. Long before George Lucas came up with calling Genosis the world where the Empire makes their clones from Boba Fett's dad or whatever. I did want to say that what's really strange about the 2010 is that the novel that it's based on is a sequel to 2001, the movie, with some things from the book in it. So, like, when we talk about how all this continuity-heavy movies and all that popular stuff, the really geeky stuff that, you know, fanboys or whatever talk about now, and it's sort of gone over to popular culture with Harry Potter and Twilight and all that crap. It was around in science fiction stuff, you know, and comic books a long time ago. And so, I mean, that's kind of a weird thing to write a sequel to the movie of your book.
Yeah.
And then I guess when he wrote the next one, it's a sequel to the movie, to 2010.
Crazy, Pop.
Then they didn't make that into a movie. So the third one, which he wrote in like 14 days, it's like 192 pages.
The fourth book.
That's what I'm thinking of. 3001, that he wanted Tom Hanks to be in the movie. It's basically all about how I'm trying to remember. It's the last science fiction book I ever read. Actually,
oh wow!
I stopped reading this. I was just like, you know, this is just crap. I'm not, you know, wasting any of my time with this. I was also like 19, so it was about time. But it's basically about how the humans need Europa, so they're going to take it back. So they have to like fight Hal and Starchild, Dave Bowman, or something. I mean, it's just like it'd make a terrible, wonderful action movie. Peter Hames ought to make it. You could get Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren to be in it.
Speaking of making villains out of Hal and Dave, it's kind of weird how Hal is brought back and doesn't become the villain again, but they keep teasing it. And it feels like a bit of a cheat because Hal is kind of inconsequential except for getting to send that message back to Earth, which, you know, they could have had something else do. But it's, yeah, I think, it was just like there was no real reason to bring back Hal except that it's Hal and it's one of the iconic things from the first one. But
yeah.
Hal is not given any good scenes.
No, not a single one, which is, you know, incredible.
Keep waiting for
guy.
You know,
character had the best death scene in cinema. Doesn't get a single good scene in his resurrection.
Even the scene where he's coming back to life is lame.
Oh man!
Where Bob Balaban is in a perfect replica of the the memory room where Dave has to pull out the cubes and where Hal starts singing Daisy Daisy and I'm losing my mind, Dave. You know, Bob Balaban's in a perfect replica of that room and he's sticking Hal's memory cubes back in and, you know, the best they could come up with is for Hal to keep repeating the same few sentences over and over with his voice sounding weird until finally it's back to normal. Like, how great would it have been if you heard him, you know, if you heard Hal, you know, because, I mean, he seems self-aware, right?
Right.
If you heard him, you know, like being born as his memory was coming back, like what would the sound of a computer that was turned off, turning back on, what would the sound of a computer waking up sound like if a computer was a person, like Hal?
There's also
wasted opportunity.
Like, again, when we're saying that 2001, the questions it raises that it doesn't even answer about itself. At the beginning, Bob Balaban's going to unplug his blue computer, the female Hal.
Mm-hmm. Sal.
And Sal, and see how that affects her. There's no follow-up to the scene. It's an idiotic scene where he names the new project Phoenix and is going to cry a little about Hal. Whereas instead we could have actually seen that. And then there's the whole thing, will I dream? Well, nobody ever explains to us if she dreamed or not. Because it's not like Sal, he didn't do these experiments on the computer, and we don't know the answer to the question that Hal later asks of whether or not he will dream. And of course Hal wouldn't dream, because he's about to be blown up by his son, which is a little bit different than... And the whole dreaming thing is stupid because it's a computer, regardless of whether or not it's artificial intelligence. If it doesn't have a sleep mode, how's it going to go?
It didn't have sleep mode in 84.
Exactly. It didn't have sleep mode in 84's 2010. And that's another thing is that in 2001, you know, that was 1968, and they were like, okay, where are we going to be in, what was it, 33 years? Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, if we'd kept spending all of our money on space, we could have
right,
been there.
Right, right.
And then by 84, we should have pretty much known that we weren't going to be doing that. And so it doesn't fit anymore that that's where the future would be. And it's kind of, I don't know. I think it's just the Earth scenes at the beginning where it's so clearly 1984 that it just...
It gets it off on the wrong foot right away.
And I think he did that to be... I think he did it intentionally because, I mean, the way he introduces space as sort of a very worker... And Outland is a lot like that. Space is... It's de-glamorized. Of course, Outland also had this... one of those great Jerry Goldsmith scores. And I actually like David Shire's music in this, but...
I kept thinking it sounded like imitation Jerry Goldsmith music.
Yeah.
And I was expecting it to be Jerry Goldsmith.
No, it's David Shire. And he repeats the same stuff over and over again. And I think 2010 was one of the first CD releases, the soundtrack of it. Like, that was a big deal in 84 that it came out on CD.
Do you want to mention the other technological innovation of this movie?
There's another technological innovation?
Yes. According to Wikipedia, and according to a making of book that was published.
The email thing.
Back when they made paperback books about the making of movies. Hames and Clark were using an early version of email to communicate about the movie during pre-production.
I think I had that book when I was a kid, and it's really boring.
And the book is supposed to be transcripts of their conversations.
Yeah, it's real boring. And apparently Hames says that Stanley Kubrick gave him his blessing to make this.
He did. I bet he regretted it.
I'm sure Kubrick never saw this.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't want to see how good a job they could do
without him.
recreating those sets that he had destroyed on purpose.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's interesting, I mean, yeah, we've already gone from talking about the movie to Kubrick, but he and Clark were friends even after all this, because Clark did a treatment of AI, apparently, when Kubrick was working on it in the 90s. So apparently Clark utterly commercializing their joint venture did not dampen their friendship any. But I guess if you live in a castle in England and don't see anybody, and your friend lives on a African island and doesn't see anybody, it doesn't really hurt much when people do stuff like that. But I mean, I don't even know if there are cutscenes from this movie. I mean, it doesn't say on IMDb. There has been no special edition. There's a really lame making of on the one of the DVDs that's really short, but it's not like they ever even brought Hames in to do a cheapo commentary, because there could be 45 minutes of deleted scenes that could be all character stuff. Who knows? But whatever.
Didn't it seem like Lithgow should have played one of the Russians?
You said that last time. Actually, this is the most I've liked Lithgow in a movie from the 80s. Like, this is what I think he should have done in the 80s instead of playing psychotic killers like he did in Cliffhanger. He should have just been the schmoey white guy. Like, he is in this, and he is in Terms of Endearment. He's just the schmoey white guy. And then you turn around and you see him as the cross-dressing killer in Raising Kane. I mean,
I think his finest film performance is in Twilight Zone, the movie.
I haven't seen that, actually. Or if I did, I saw it when I was six, so...
Well, George Miller directs him in a remake of the Shatner Gremlin on the Wing segment, and he's great. And he bugs out and stuff, but, you know, at least he's not the villain in that. He's the victim. And it's actually a lot like when he's freaking out in this movie about having to go into space.
Well, that's the thing. They have these scenes in this movie where it's very, I'm not going to say meticulous, but it's drawn out. We have the whole scene where he and the other guy go into the ship, into the Discovery. It takes 15 minutes out of a 115-minute running time. And then we skip on fast forward through all the other stuff they do. You know, it's just like Hal takes 2 minutes to turn back on.
Yeah.
We got one scene with Balaban telling everybody, well, I think he's okay. And then you got the little red calculator that apparently is going to transmit through space.
Yeah.
Now, they have this kind of technology, and we're still messing around. I mean, that's what's so absurd about Hames' Cold War problems. These are very 1984 political 1984 standoffs to have. Mm-hmm. They are not 2010 in the world of the movie standoff staff, because their technology is insane. They should be fighting over the moon or something.
Yeah.
They should be fighting over Mars or something, you know? It's like,
yeah.
They shouldn't be fighting over Honduras.
Oh man, that would be a good movie. Red Planet. You should have made it in the 80s though.
Red what?
Have a movie about a American Soviet war for Mars and call it Red Planet.
Or
Angry Red Planet, or whatever.
They could have remade, yeah, when they remade, what are they remaking right now?
Red
with
Dawn.
All the teen, Red Dawn. They should just change
on
it.
On Mars, yeah.
They've put it on Mars. All they got to do is put a red filter over the movie like they did the, what was Red Planet is the Val Kilmer one.
Uh-huh.
That they just shoot it through a red filter, or they put it post-production in a red filter. Yeah, they should just do that with the new Red Dawn remake. But
you know what else the Cold War thing reminded me of at the end? The fact that, you know, existence of intelligent life makes the Soviets and Americans decide to lay down their arms. That's just as stupid as it was in Watchmen. And did Alan Moore see this crappy movie before he wrote Watchmen? Because as much as I love Watchmen, I never ever bought the ending where, you know, just because a big alien crashed into New York, a big fake alien, that Russia would feel bad and you know.
They got to take over the U.S. essentially, though. I mean, remember at the very end of Watchmen, they're walking around and all the diners have now changed their names to Russian names.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, but yeah. It's still, I mean...
Alan Moore did not see 2010. I think I can guarantee that Alan Moore
did
not
the same,
see.
It's just the same idea that I don't buy that, like, a big event is going to... I mean, if aliens landed in the middle of World War II, World War II still would have had to happen. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's like just because something fantastical enters doesn't mean that the sheer awe of this fantastic thing puts an end to war. That's a really, really kind of pacifist assumption, and it's really naive. And yeah, it's always struck me as naive.
Well, the thing about this is, though, were they really fighting yet? They were talking about aircraft carriers, and I'm like, it's 2010, don't you have anything better than aircraft carriers? And you're in space anyway, so
yeah.
Obviously, you know, you should have laser planes. Really, we didn't make any laser planes in between 2001 and 2010. But actually seeing it and seeing it take place in 2010 is kind of weird, since it's, you know, next week, I thought, at the beginning. Yeah, I was just like, oh yeah, 2001, oh no. And I think the 2001, the movie, has this mythic quality to it where you don't automatically go, oh, wow, yeah, we've already passed that. But 2010 has no mythic qualities, and you're just kind of like, oh, wow, yeah. Mm-hmm. No. What else is there to say? Oh, the very ending with the monolith on the jungle planet that looks like basically the jungle planet from Star Trek II. Wow, that's,
apparently the novel has a epilogue where it's the year 3001 and the evolved beings evolved when it's so evolved they evolved in 1,000 years.
It's in Wikipedia says it's,
2001, my bad. So 20,000 years later, the new intelligent life, on the planet Europa is they're thinking about, well, our sun is died out by now.
No, because I think it's in the sky.
Yeah,
isn't it? Yeah, it's still in the sky.
Well, whatever. I mean, even if the movie just did that, I mean, it would have helped raise that epic quality just a tad. But you know, the most epic, and I mean, this movie is, like, unable to inspire awe, and it's unable to, I mean, it makes space boring, put it that way.
With really good special effects, yeah, too, which really bugs you.
It manages to make space boring, even though it looks great.
Yeah.
But the most, you know, the most awe-inspiring thing is David Bowman coming back to Earth as this, you know, ghost, and,
they don't do anything with it.
Yeah, it's just kind of a scene, you know.
Well, I think I said that was the last thing, but here's my really last thing. The opening, "My God, it's full of stars." The quoted at the beginning of the film is supposedly Bowman's last transmission, but it wasn't in the. It was in the novel, but not in the movie. 2001. I think, like, that transmission drives Roy Scheider's character nuts in the book. In this, they should have left it out, because it's annoying as all hell, as is the way they Keir Dulia's voice through, like, a digitizer.
Yeah.
Too. I mean, it's just like, Hames keeps in these tidbits from the novel, but he doesn't seem to realize that he's not actually adapting the full novel. He's doing his little Cold War thing, and it's only 115 minutes long. And he maybe should snip-snip here and snip-snip there, like the entire beginning on Earth. But yeah. Dolphins. What's up with the dolphins?
Well, that was like that was more near-futuristic than futuristic, I thought. But it's like one of the few pathetic gestures they make to make Earth seem like it's a little bit in the future and society is a little bit different.
That everybody has a dolphin in their house?
People have pet dolphins in their house. They have pools for dolphins.
Day of the Dolphin was 71. Wasn't that about dolphins with George C. Scott? I've never seen it, but...
Is it about dolphins attacking people?
No, I think it's just about dolphins being smart or whatever. I mean, That's 15 years before they made this movie.
Like Phase 4 with dolphins?
No. Phase 4 is about the ants.
I know. But it's about what happens if ants were really intelligent.
Weren't they space ants?
I've never seen it.
Oh, I think they're space ants. Anyway, yeah, so I guess, yeah, that would be one of the future things. And his laptop on the beach when you get to see his ripped abs.
And we get to see him at home, too.
Well, yeah, when the little...
He makes his kids spot him to do...
When his freakishly young son, as opposed to his freakishly young wife, is... I mean, that's the thing about Roy Scheider, and I was thinking that, you know, in Jaws, he's married to a woman the same age as him. In Blue Thunder, he's romancing Candy Clark, who's not, I mean, she's probably younger than him, but not, you know, remarkably. And in this one, he's like freaking, what is it, you know, Humphrey Bogart and Sabrina, 54 years old, right, hitting on 20-year-old Audrey Hepburn or something. I mean, it's just like, he's I don't know. And when he's got the scenes with Helen Mirren, and they're actually nearer the same age, it, I don't know, whatever. Yeah. So 2010, I actually would say that if you haven't seen it and you're under the age of, what, 18, 19, and you like film, you should probably see it. I mean, just so you can know what the heck people were doing in 1984 when they were trying to make blockbusters and failed, but otherwise,
trying to see how people incorporated their lame politics into special effects movies back then as opposed to today with James Cameron.
Supposedly. Well, no, because nobody thought the Cold War was good. It's not even like politics. It's not even Peter Hames doing that. It's just, I mean, it's even lamer than that because he has no position. Whatsoever.
Except that the Cold War is bad. And
the Cold War is bad.
America and Russia shouldn't start World War III.
Yeah, and which is really, people have been saying that since it started, right? Uh-huh. I mean, yeah, so, okay. Anyway, yeah, 2001, 10.
We've run over on this, but...
We've run over...
We're
going to
run really long next week.
Yes.
Because we're talking about three movies, and they're called RoboCop, RoboCop 2, and RoboCop 3. And we love RoboCop. we have mixed feelings about the second one, and the third one's a piece of crap. So it is like one and one-third movies. And mm-hmm.
Now, have you ever seen the entire third one?
Oh no, that's the other thing, is that I've never gotten through it. So,
okay, so you have to watch all of it.
Yeah, it's gonna be a new experience for me.
You have to watch the ninja RoboCop fight the ninja.
I've seen that. You know,
that's at the end.
I know, but I've seen it. It used to play on TV a lot. That's what I'm saying.
Okay,
that's how I saw.
There's
it.
The jetpack.
That's how I. Yeah, I've seen that too. Yeah, and the little girl reprogramming the ED-209 through its foot still
with the only stop motion in the entire film.
Haunts,
yes,
still haunts my dreams, but we'll get to all that next week. It's going to be a very special Alan Smithy podcast.
Our first of 2010.
The RoboCop special, I guess because now it's officially the future. It's RoboCop.
It's the year. Well, except RoboCop took place in 1997, right?
Actually,
anyway,
unnamed year, but
well, no, but I think that was in some of the publicity materials.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, okay. So that's next time.
That's next week. Join us, and this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
This has been an Alan Smithy podcast. Thanks for listening.